You're listening to a program produced in 2011 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To learn more about Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Tonight we are here to celebrate Annie Murphy Paul's book, Origins, How the 9 months Before Birth Shaped the Rest of Our Lives. I assume some of you are pregnant and many of you are not, but we all were born, so there is much for all of us to learn. The format will be a conversation between Annie and Dr. Michael Liu, after which we will open up to you for questions. Maureen and Sarah will be circulating microphones because we do record for podcasts, so we ask that you wait until a microphone comes to you. And afterwards, Annie Murphy Paul will be signing her book in the lobby, thanks to our library store. Annie Murphy Paul's field research starts with her own experience as a mother-to-be and showcases her formidable skills as a writer-researcher. As Dr. Perry Klass noted in the Washington Post, it makes perfect sense that a pregnant science writer would find herself wondering about the science of pregnancy. Paul balances her investigations of current research in the emerging field of fetal origins with her own emotions as a pregnant woman, the desperate desire to keep the developing fetus safe, the difficult lesson that, in the adventure of creating life, not everything can be controlled. She chronicles how we went in just a few decades from the attitudes we see on Mad Men, pregnant women smoking, clinking martinis, to the anxious attitudes of our own time. In fact, I spent this past weekend hiking with an old friend of mine who is a DES baby, which some of you know about. Her life has been severely impacted by a drug her mother was prescribed to prevent miscarriage. It was actually prescribed for 4 million American women. And the discovery of the link between DES and vaginal cancer in women is one of those breakthroughs that brought attention to the fetus's vulnerability. Now we know so much more, and there is so much more we're on the verge of learning, and after reading Annie Murphy Paul's book, you'll never think about pregnancy in the same way. It's a beautiful, beautiful book. Annie Murphy Paul is a former senior editor at Psychology Today magazine. She was awarded the Rosalind Carter Fellowship for Mental Health Journalism. She's the author of The Cult of Personality, How Personality Tests Are Leading Us to Miseducate Our Children, Mismanage Our Companies, and Misunderstand Ourselves. And we're delighted to have Annie Murphy Paul with us here tonight. And we're also very honored to have Dr. Michael C. Liu in conversation with Annie Murphy Paul. He is here all the way from Westwood, California, no mean feat on a Tuesday night. Dr. Liu is the Associate Professor of Obstetrics and Gynecology and Public Health at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and at the UCLA School of Public Health. He's a member of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention's Select Panel on Preconception Care, and he's a lead investigator for the National Children's Study in Los Angeles. He's received numerous awards for his teaching, including Excellence in Teaching Awards from the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics, and he's the author of Get Ready to Get Pregnant. And now, please get ready to welcome Annie Murphy Paul and Dr. Michael C. Liu. Thank you so much.
Hi, Annie.
Hi, Michael.
I'm so glad for this opportunity to talk to you about this book. I read it, I loved it, and I'm so glad that you gave me this conversation to have this opportunity to have a conversation with you.
Me too.
So I got a bunch of questions for you, but first of all, just let me start by congratulating you on just the success of this book. You, think, managed to do what many of us in academia haven't been able to do with our books, and that is to spread the word about this whole new, exciting area of scientific research called fetal origins. I think you basically put fetal origins on the map. Okay? So how did you come about to writing this book?
Well, thank you for your congratulations, Michael. And I should hasten to say that I could never have written the book at all if it weren't for the work of you and some of the other researchers that you mentioned, you know, David Barker and Peter Nathaniels. You know, I'm just a scribbler. I'm just, you guys discover the knowledge and I write it down. So, but I wonder too if the attention that the book was fortunate enough to get was in part a matter of timing, because although the initial discoveries, you know, David Barker's discoveries 30 years ago, set the stage for the emerging field of fetal origins, it's been building slowly over that time, and maybe it had reached a point where there was enough attention being paid, enough news being made, that people, when my book came out, said, you know, it's time to learn something about this. And that's exactly how it happened for me, that I'm a science writer, and part of my job is to trawl through the academic journals, looking through all the dull stuff and the boring stuff, and find those really fascinating, surprising, interesting new findings that kind of, you know, catch my eye. And over the last few years, I had been seeing just an explosion of research concerning the prenatal period and its effects on later life. Can you hear me? And so I wanted to investigate that. And what I found was a group of incredibly dedicated researchers who were providing really fresh and interesting answers to old important questions, like what makes us who we are. That to me is the most interesting question in the world, and one that in one way or another I think all of my writing is about. And here was an answer that was neither nature nor nurture exactly as we'd come to think of it, although genes are involved. It's not just about the genes that we inherit at conception. It's how they're expressed largely in the in utero stage. And it's nurture, but it's not the kind of nurture that we've come to think about in terms of the care and attention that we give to our children after birth. This is all what happens during the 9 months of the preconception, of the prenatal period. So this was really intriguing to me, really thought-provoking to me, and I had already at this point been pregnant once, so I'd been through those 9 months of waiting and wondering and thinking about how what I did as a pregnant woman affected my child and what my child would be like. And then in the middle of this research that I was doing into the field of fetal origins, I got pregnant again, and I took that as a definite omen, an unmistakable omen that I was on the right track, and that I should not only continue to investigate this area of science, but build my own experience into the book. And that is what I did with Origins. I built the book around the 9 months of my own pregnancy. And each month while I was pregnant, I set out to interview a different group of researchers, delve into another set of research findings, and try to find out what I could about how certain prenatal influences affected the fetus. So diet and nutrition, stress, trauma, mood, exposure to drugs and other chemicals. In that way, meld my identity as a science writer with my identity as a pregnant woman. And so I wonder also if in the past we've had a hard time getting traction for these ideas, if one reason might be that that you and David Barker and Peter Nathaniels can't get pregnant. You know, I mean, if you guys had been able to write about being pregnant, I think that maybe made it a bit more accessible to women, or less like a scientist saying, here's what you should do, because I was really in the same boat as the women readers.
Right, and I think that's what's fascinating about this book. It's not just a story about scientific discoveries, but it's also a personal story as well. Although I have to say that you probably were told by some people that it's probably a little crazy to immerse yourself in all kind of this fetal origins research while you were pregnant to know all the things that could go wrong worrying about how the 9 months before birth can influence the rest of your son's life.
Yeah, no pressure.
No pressure. But you said that it actually gave you a new attitude, right? I like what you said on NPR, that you said, I quote, "My immersion in fetal origins research made me less anxious about being pregnant, not more." Explain to us a little more about this whole new attitude.
Well, people did tell me I was crazy for looking into this while I was pregnant. I mean, I saw it as the ultimate in life-work balance. You know, I was already thinking about being pregnant because I was pregnant, and there I could be writing about it as well. And there were, I'll be honest, there were some sort of hairy moments. So when I was, I think particularly of a chapter that I wrote about the effects of drugs during pregnancy, and I got into the history of thalidomide and DES and some of these drugs that caused awful consequences in offspring. So there were a few moments like that. But by and large, as I said on NPR, I came out of my studies with a more positive attitude about pregnancy. Excuse me. And that's because I was going beyond the media messages, which I think is what so many women get, just these bulletins that from, you know, here and there, and you hear about it from your friends or your mother, you know, don't do this, don't do that, this is dangerous. And I was able to get beyond that because as a science writer, I could go to the researchers themselves and hear about what they were doing, what they thought was important, about what they were finding. And when I talked to them, what they were not full of dire warnings or sort of gloom and doom. They were very excited and enthusiastic about this new opportunity that we had. That's how they saw it, as an opportunity to intervene in public health problems at an earlier stage, allowing sort of unprecedented success in areas that had really been very resistant to solutions like child obesity. And they were seeing pregnancy not in terms of the things that could go wrong, but in terms of the many, many things that go right, and how pregnancy can be really the wellspring of health and well-being if we're able to support pregnant women and pregnant women are able to get what they need. So that's exactly what I wanted to share with readers of Origins, and I hope that's the positive attitude that I conveyed, because that's really what I was able to take out of my research.
So for those in the audience who haven't read your book, what is that fetal origins hypothesis?
Well, I hope that maybe you'll be able to, after I give my simple-minded explanation, you can give a more nuanced one, Michael, because he's really the expert. But the fetal origins hypothesis is the idea that the origins of health and disease really begin during fetal life, which doesn't sound like such an astonishing idea. You know, the body is made in those 9 months, and that's, you know, the beginning of all of our lives. So it's not, in a way, it's not so surprising, but it is kind of mind-bending when you put it into the context of, you know, how do we think that heart disease begins? How do we think that diabetes or hypertension begins? Usually we think first of perhaps of genes. You have a family history. You know, it's just in my genes, I'm sort of doomed to get to be overweight or to have diabetes. You might think of childhood experiences, you know, or conditions such as you were malnourished or overnourished, and you might think of adult lifestyle choices. You have a sedentary lifestyle. You have you eat poorly or you smoke cigarettes, and these are the reasons why people are healthy or not healthy. And the fetal origins hypothesis was proposing something radically different, that actually it was those 9 months in between conception and birth, which we really hadn't given much thought to, that are crucial for your health and well-being, you know, many decades down the road. So it's a kind of mind-bending when you really think about it. And that helps explain, I think, why it's taken so long to achieve acceptance, because it's not only is it hard to wrap your head around, it's also hard for those of us who were fetuses a long time ago to come to grips with the fact that there are some things that were, you know, that happened then that perhaps weren't optimal. But then again, we can also use that knowledge to improve our health now, and we can definitely use that knowledge to improve the health of women and pregnant women and fetuses now. So what was your question, Michael? It was that, what was the definition of the fetal origins hypothesis?
What's the fetal origins hypothesis?
Yeah, which I think you explained. I would be interested if there's a more kind of concise scientific definition that you would use in your work.
Probably, yeah, I mean, I think a lot of us use the term fetal programming, and it's pretty much what it sounds like, right? It's like programming a computer. There are these sensitive or critical periods during development during which the function of an organ or system is being programmed. And if things don't go right, if something goes wrong with that fetal programming, then that organ or system may never function optimally over the entire life course. So a simple-minded example is that if you were to get undernutrition in the second trimester when the pancreas or the kidneys are rapidly growing, you end up with a smaller pancreas with fewer beta cells, or you end up with a smaller kidneys with fewer nephrons, and so they might not work as well over the life course, which then put you at greater risk for diabetes and kidney diseases 40, 50 years later on. And again, a lot of this came out of the work of one man in a stroke of genius, this British physician named David Barker. And you talked about that discovery there. What were the things that led up to like his eureka moment?
So David Barker is a cardiologist, and he now has an appointment in America, but he's British and has a career in Britain. And he, 30 years ago, it started with David Barker looking at a map, and he was looking at a map of the British Isles, and on this map were the rates of heart disease for each area. And he noticed something surprising, which was that the areas that were poorest, that were most economically disadvantaged, had the highest rates of heart disease. And this was puzzling to him, because we think of heart disease as being a disease of the affluent, you know, of sedentary lifestyles, of too much rich food. And yet here, this map was showing him that it was the poor areas of the country that had these high rates of heart disease. This piqued his interest, and he began to inquire in directions that other scientists were not going. And what he discovered was that, and the way he did it is he collected the birth records. He had an intuition or a sense that perhaps this vulnerability to heart disease began very, very early. So he collected the birth records of thousands and thousands of Britons, and traced them, found those people now in late middle age, and compared their birth weights to their health as adults. And he found a very strong connection between low birth weight and heart disease many, many decades later. So this was very surprising and puzzling, and David Barker began generating a hypothesis out of this data that suggested that perhaps fetuses in these lower income areas had been malnourished in the womb, and in a kind of act of triage had diverted nutrients to the brain, which allows the fetus to keep itself alive, to be born, but weakens the heart in a way that ultimately that bill comes due many, many, many years later. I talked to David Barker. He's a funny, kind of curmudgeonly guy. And I don't know if he started out curmudgeonly or if he's just really mad that his views have been ignored for 30 years. But I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. I was saying that
malnourished,
yeah. I talked to David Barker. Anyway, David Barker. Oh yes, so I talked to David Barker about how his views were received when he shared them with the medical community, and he has all kinds of stories about how he was laughed out of the room, derided, ridiculed. And my favorite story was when he was finally sort of grudgingly invited to a conference of scientists in America, even though no one really wanted him to be there. And when he showed up, there was no name tag for him. They had not. So they finally scrounged around and they found one that said technician, and they gave him that one. And they gave him a speaking slot that was like at 8 o'clock at night, and he goes in and it's a practically empty lecture hall. So it was really a long, hard road for him to make his views respected. And yet, over these last 20 or 30 years, there's been such an enormous amount of research that's been done that ends up supporting Barker, not only his original hypothesis, but even extending beyond that to other kinds of diseases, you know, hypertension, diabetes, obesity. So it's really, it's taken a long time, but I think it's really coming into its own now.
Yeah, and again, I just want you to just see what an extraordinary insight that was. So if I were to ask you all, tell me some risk factors for heart disease. What would you tell me? Smoking, high cholesterol, obesity, French fries, okay. Stress, okay. Low birth weight. Who would have told me about low birth weight? What does being born low birth weight have anything to do with your risk for heart disease 50 years later? And that's that where that whole notion of fetal programming comes in, that there are these very critical periods during development. If things don't go right, then that organ, the heart, may never develop, may never function optimally over the entire life course. Now, of course, you know, I, like many others, were skeptics at first when we heard about the Barker hypothesis. But as you mentioned, over the last 3 decades, there's been this explosion of scientific evidence that's now really beginning to support this whole notion of fetal origins. And I think probably one of the most dramatic pieces of scientific evidence actually came out of a tragedy in the Dutch famine study. Mm-hmm. And you talked about that in your
book. Yes, yeah, because this is one of the best known pieces of evidence supporting Barker's hypothesis, which is actually what it was called for a long time. Everyone called it Barker's hypothesis. Like, it's his. He did it. Like, we don't have anything to do with that. But so it was Barker's hypothesis for a long time, and a lot of the evidence. Perhaps one of the reasons that it took so long to reach acceptance is that it's obviously very difficult to do the kinds of experiments that you'd want to do to either prove or disprove a theory like Barker's. You can't take a group of pregnant women and starve half of them and overfeed the other half and see what happens. But there are sometimes what scientists call experiments of nature, which is when some often dramatic event happens in the real world that create fortuitous circumstances for investigation by scientists. And that this is what happened in 1944 during World War II, when the Nazis placed much of the Netherlands under siege. They didn't allow any food shipments into the country, and this was during an incredibly cold winter, so cold that the canals froze. It was a very difficult time. And so the Dutch went from being well-fed, kind of prosperous Western Europeans to being living in starvation conditions. They ate an average of 500 calories a day, which is a tiny fraction of what they were used to eating. Some people resorted to eating tulip bulbs just to stay alive. And this went on until May of 1945, when suddenly the Allies liberated Holland and the siege was over. And many thousands of people died from malnutrition during what came to be known as the hunger winter, the Dutch hunger winter. But what people didn't realize at the time was that there was also going to be kind of a delayed effect on the 40,000 fetuses who were in utero during the hunger winter. And if they had survived to be born, then it was thought that that was the end of the story. And of course, as soon as Holland was liberated, they went right back to their sort of pre-war ample Western diet. But what had happened from, you know, if we can take the fetuses' perspective, so to speak, They were getting messages in the womb about what to expect about the world that they would soon be encountering once they were born. And that those messages were saying, you're being born into a world of incredible scarcity. Your body needs to hold on to every calorie. And so their bodies were programmed in that fashion. They were, their metabolism and their physiological processes and organs were set up to support that kind of lifestyle. But then they were, that forecast turned out to be inaccurate. They were born into a world of plenty and abundance. So when scientists went back decades later and took a look at these people who'd been in utero during the hunger winter, they found higher rates of diabetes, obesity, heart disease, hypertension, because of this mismatch between what they had been led to expect, if you can put it that way, as fetuses, and what they really encountered once they were born. So that this experiment of nature provided sort of one of the foundational stones that eventually became this wall of evidence supporting David Barker.
And this match between the cues that the baby's getting inside the womb and the world that they're being born into, we think maybe what's driving this whole obesity epidemic that's sweeping many parts of the developing world. But then in America, as in other parts of the developed world, we have an opposite problem, right? So we're not necessarily talking about undernutrition, but overnutrition. And we have a whole obesity epidemic that's going on among women childbearing age and among children. Okay? So could overnutrition also do something to the baby inside the womb?
Yeah. Well, as you say, our problem in this country is for the most part not undernutrition, but overnutrition. And in fact, I wrote an article a couple years ago for the New York Times Magazine about a new specialty in medicine called bariatric obstetrics. And this was a specialty developing to help doctors give birth to babies of really obese women, grossly, massively obese women. So it's like an entirely different specialty that requires particular kinds of instruments and tables and accommodations for these women. And this was something new. Doctors were not really seeing very, very obese women giving birth until fairly recently. So that's at one end of the spectrum. In the middle of the spectrum, we're seeing a lot more overweight women giving birth in America. And, I think we need to wonder and we need to find out whether our growing obesity problem has its roots in partly in the womb, because it appears to be the case that the intrauterine environment provided by an overweight or obese woman is different in such a way that it may predispose the offspring itself to obesity. I think not all the mechanisms are understood. I mean, for one thing, the idea that humans would have an excess of food is so evolutionarily novel that there's no kind of adaptive response to it. I mean, you might imagine in an ideal world, if you're overfed in the womb, then you would develop one of those really great metabolisms where you can eat anything you want and you know, the pounds fall off. But that's not what happens. In fact, it's just the opposite. And the most interesting set of experiments to me to demonstrate how this works was done by a scientist named John Kral and some of his collaborators. He looked at women who gave birth while they were obese, and then these same women happened to go and get anti-obesity surgery, the kind of, you know, bariatric surgeries where your stomach is banded or there's other ways of preventing people from gaining weight. And so then they got pregnant again, having had this surgery. And this time, they're skinny mothers. You know, they're mothers who are normal weight. And the first group of children who were born of obese mothers have a very high incidence of being obese themselves. The children of the same mother, same genes, but women who provided an intrauterine environment that was not that of an obese woman, they are no more likely to be obese than the general population. And in the words of one of the scientists that I interviewed, they were normalized. They were effectively normalized by their prenatal experience. So I found that really stunning and really a strong argument for women who are thinking of getting pregnant and public health officials who want to help those women to talk about the importance of becoming as healthy as possible before you have a baby, and that can in some cases mean losing weight.
And as I mentioned earlier, I was initially skeptic, but I think, you know, it wasn't until I started reading some of the animal studies that's looking at the mechanisms of how fetal origins might work, that's beginning to persuade me about the biological plausibility of fetal origins. And I think you described in your book this probably one of the most fascinating research on the agouti mice. Mm-hmm. And by the way, I just have to say I was so impressed by the fact that you were how you were able to explain things like methylation or epigenetics, which my editor told me to take out my book because you know, they just say that the general public just wouldn't get it. And you were able to really describe that in a very accessible way. Can you describe what happened in that agouti mice?
Yeah. Well, I'll do better than that. I'll read that passage that you make sure that I get it right. then we can talk about it. So epigenetics is another kind of emerging body of knowledge. We're coming to understand that when we receive our genetic inheritance at conception, that's not the end of the story. It's not like that creates a blueprint that is unchanging for the rest of our lives. Actually, our genes, our genome, is constantly being altered. You can kind of think of it like a soundboard, that there are genes that are being flipped on and off, or the volume's being turned up or down, depending on input from the environment. And so that means that especially during the prenatal period, our genetic endowment is much more flexible than we ever realized before. So, and one of the early experiments that established this is the one that I talk about in the book, and I'll just read it right here. We now know that epigenetic mechanisms, and I should add that epigenetic means above the genes, so it's like there's the genetic code, and then there's above that code, there's another one that kind of modulates how the genes are expressed or how they behave. We now know that epigenetic mechanisms help explain how a pregnant woman's diet can have lasting effects on her offspring. One of the ways a gene's expression can be altered is through the action of a chemical cluster known as a methyl group. By attaching itself to a gene, a methyl group can turn that gene on or off. So, in effect, the methyl group is like it flips a switch. So that's the mechanism by which these genes can be turned on or off, up or down. Especially while offspring are in utero, what their mothers do or eat can methylate particular genes in the offspring, changing how those genes behave. This was demonstrated in 2003 in a striking experiment performed by Duke University scientists Randy Jertle and Robert Waterland. And it really is a very striking illustration. The researchers started out with two groups of agouti mice, a strain of mice with yellow fur, fat bodies, and a predisposition to diabetes and cancer. A few decades ago, we would have assumed that these mice and their descendants were stuck with such characteristics. It's in their genes, after all. But now we know that agouti mice have the appearance and physiology they do because a certain gene, the agouti gene, is being continuously expressed. So this one gene has been turned on in these mice, and that's why they have those characteristics. In these mice, the agouti gene has been activated, and so Jertle thought perhaps it could be deactivated. He fed one group of pregnant mice a regular diet. The other group of pregnant mice received a diet rich in methyl donors, nutrients capable of making methyl groups available in the body. So one group of mice is getting a regular diet. The other one is getting a diet full of these chemical clusters that can turn on or off a gene. The pups born of the first group of mice looked just like their parents, fat and yellow, and had a tendency to develop the same health problems. But the pups born of the mice who ate an enriched diet during pregnancy were different. They had brown fur, they were slender, and they were more likely to be healthy without their parents' predispositions to disease. Their DNA hadn't changed. They still carried the agouti gene, but their epigenomes had, and it was parental nutrition that flipped the switch. In ways that scientists are just beginning to understand, maternal diet during human pregnancy can also modify the fetus's epigenome in ways that affect its future health and well-being. So as I say, there's still a lot that we don't know about this, but it seems to be the case that epigenetic mechanisms can explain why and how things that a woman does when she's pregnant can have such striking effects on her fetus, and that it happens at this epigenetic level that is not genes in the way that we usually think of it, but is not entirely nurture in the way that we think of it either. It's this very interesting kind of gray zone.
So you imagine that. Someday being able to tell our patients that we know how to flip on those genes that's going to confer upon your baby good health and longevity, and switch off those genes that's going to cause heart disease, cancer, and diabetes before your baby was ever born. Okay. And we're certainly nowhere close to being able to say that today. I do have to caution against extrapolating too much from one animal studies, just because not all humans are rats. But yeah, I certainly think that this is probably one of the earliest and best examples of how early nutrition can impact on your DNA methylation, and that such epigenetic changes can actually have permanent and perhaps even transgenerational impact on health and function. But I guess knowing all of that, how were you able to enjoy foods anymore during pregnancy?
Well, I start out by loving food. So it takes a lot to get me not to love food, but all the prohibitions and warnings and scoldings that come along with so much of what pregnant women read and hear, you know, could turn anybody off of food. And I tried in writing this book to look for an alternative to that, because food is so important and because pleasure is important and pregnancy shouldn't be some kind of 9-month, you know, slog. So, and I did find ways to enjoy food when I was pregnant. One was that my sense was that we have to think about food more when we're pregnant anyway. There are, you know, kind of food safety things that we need to keep in mind, and we certainly need to eat a wholesome diet. But if we're going to be thinking about food more anyway, why not use pregnancy as kind of an excuse, kind of a liberation to think more about food, to take more care with our food, to, you know, visit the farmer's market more often, or to spend a little more time over your food shopping, or to try a new cookbook. And I did find that I made changes in my diet for the good when I was pregnant that lasted, you know, well after I had had my babies. And I think this is part of the revolution in thinking about pregnancy that I hope I'm advancing with this book, which is that pregnancy doesn't have to be a time when you're always worrying about what you're doing wrong, but rather it can be an opportunity to make positive changes that will improve your life even when you're not pregnant. And then the other part of it that allowed me to enjoy eating and food while I was pregnant was what I learned about what the fetus can taste and smell in the womb. And this was fascinating to me, that by at least the 7th month of gestation, a fetus can smell and taste foods that its mother eats. And it's thought that in the animal kingdom, this serves an adaptive function by teaching the fetus before it's even born, and also afterwards through lactation, what is safe and good to eat. You know, this is a message, again, a kind of, you know, we heard about the fetuses in utero during the Dutch hunger winter, getting learning a story, hearing an information or cues about what to expect from the world ahead. This is another way in which animals and humans, and we're animals too, are communicating something about the world outside to their fetuses before they're born. And most interestingly of all, you know, in the case of humans, we're not just communicating information about safety or appropriateness about what to eat, but also our culture, because, you know, what's a more powerful expression of our culture than food, and spices and flavorings and sort of characteristic tastes, those all are shared with the fetus well before he or she is born. And at the time that I wrote this book and that I was pregnant with my second child, I was living in Manhattan, land of the takeout and delivery, especially as it got bigger, very disinclined to cook. So my my fetus, now my son Gus, got a taste of, I think, you know, sushi, Thai, Italian pizzeria, you know, you name it. So I enjoyed feeling that I was sharing with him this sort of polyglot, you know, urban cuisine. So those things help me enjoy food, you know, during pregnancy, which I think it's a shame that many women feel that they can't.
Right. Well, let's talk about another prenatal factor that plays a very important role in fetal programming, and that's stress.
Mm-hmm.
I think in your book you talked about babies born to women who lived through some pretty extreme stress, okay, from mm-hmm. Holocaust to Katrina, wonder what's going to happen to the babies, or born to pregnant women who are in Japan right now. You were in New York City when 9/11 happened. You weren't pregnant at the time. What happened to the women who were pregnant in 9/11?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we might be surprised. I was surprised to learn that there were some 1,700 women who were in the towers or in the immediate vicinity of the World Trade Center towers when they were struck on 9/11, and they experienced all the trauma and the exposure to chemicals and the fear that we all felt that day in a very visceral way. And so scientists followed a group of these women and their babies after they were born to see what happened. And what they were able to gather from their experiments was that the babies of the women who developed PTSD in response to their experiences on 9/11 at age one showed a biological marker. They had lower cortisol levels in their blood of vulnerability to PTSD. So it appeared that in some way the pregnant woman had passed down a vulnerability to PTSD to her offspring. And this was very interesting to the woman who led this research. She's a psychologist named Rachel Yehuda, who specializes in treating Holocaust victims. And she opened in 1993 the first clinic devoted to treating the psychological issues of Holocaust victims. And what was so surprising to her was that she was getting, for every call that they got, that her clinic got from a Holocaust survivor, they were getting 5 calls from the children of Holocaust survivors who said, "I have all the symptoms of PTSD. I wasn't in the camps, but I have nightmares. I have a hypervigilant sense of that I always need to be on guard." All the kind of classic symptoms of PTSD, and she had always been very interested in how this could be, and that the traditional kind of psychoanalytically inflected explanation for that would be that, well, the Holocaust survivor parent told stories or perhaps didn't tell stories, and there was some horrible silence that the child had to fill in with her own imaginings, and this is why a second and even a third generation might experience a kind of secondhand PTSD. But in Rachel Yehuda's experiments on these children of 9/11 survivors, the children were only 1 year old. So there's no sense in which they had heard the stories, and yet they already were showing these markers of PTSD. So her feeling, and I find her, it's just a theory and requires a lot more research, but I find her theory very poignant, which is that although PTSD looks to us like and is a terrible affliction that really torments the people who have it, in some settings, you know, in the ancestral environment in which our species evolved, being on a hair trigger, being aware all the time, being always kind of seeking out evidence of danger could have been very adaptive. It could have saved someone's life. So again, it gets back to this theme, which is woven throughout my book, that the woman, the pregnant woman, is in effect telling her fetus a story about the world outside before her child is even born. And that story, in some cases, is about whether it's a world of nutrition, of abundance or scarcity, and in this case is a story about, you know, this is a dangerous world and you should watch out. So I want to emphasize, though, and I know, Michael, you feel this way too, that we're talking here about extreme stress. Mm. And I got, especially when the book came out, I got a lot of questions from women who said, well, I have a job and I have another child and I'm so busy and harried and I feel like I worry that I'm hurting my fetus because of the stress. I'm stressed about my stress, you know? And so then I would tell them about my single favorite piece of research, which is conducted by a wonderful scientist named Janet DiPietro at Johns Hopkins University, which is that she has found through a series of experiments now that moderate stress is beneficial for fetal development. So, you know, not extreme stress and not maybe a life of ease, but a kind of moderate stress, just like if you were to take a test, you would do better on the test if you were a little bit nervous. Just that little bit of stress is actually helped in the case of the fetus, helps the organs mature, helps the brain connections work faster. And Janet DiPietro told me that after she started adding this evidence to her lectures, she had pregnant women who came up to her and said, well, I my life is really easy and I want to know if there's a way that I can add the appropriate level of stress to my life. And Janet's like, well, honey, I've got some stress to share with you. But so everyone wants the right answer. But I mean, if you still, Janet DiPietro's image, which actually helped me a lot when I was pregnant, is that of an inverted U curve, that you don't want to be over here on the tail where you're, you know, obviously no one wants to have severe or extreme stress. And over here, if, you know, there's no kind of challenge or no stress at all in your life, if you can hit sort of the fat middle of that inverted U curve, then you're doing great for yourself and your baby.
So I guess to paraphrase Goldilocks, mm-hmm. not too much, not too little, but just right.
That's right.
So I think another topic that may be of great interest to the audience here is air pollution.
Mm-hmm.
So does air pollution do anything to the baby inside the womb?
Yes, and unfortunately, there's been quite a bit of evidence suggesting that can raise the risk of birth defects. And again, this is the kind of news that when it shows up in a newspaper or magazine can really freak people out. I feel the need to you know, point out that these birth defects remain but rare. They're just elevated somewhat in areas with high traffic pollution. I mean, there's so many kinds of chemicals and pollutants and things that women worry about these days. And no pregnant woman, no individual woman can clean the air and clean the water and, you know, get rid of all these potential dangers herself. So what I would tell women when they would ask me about things like air pollution or BPA, for example, in their plastic goods and all these things that we hear about, is that if you can do your best to eliminate what you can eliminate from your life of these toxins and chemicals, and if you can make peace with the fact that we all live in a world that is polluted, that isn't pure, that's perhaps the best way to protect your baby whilst, you know, preventing yourself from going crazy.
I think a very important social message that's in your book, you mentioned that the need for us all to demand more thorough testing, more informative labeling, more restrictive regulation. Why should the burden of proof be on us to show that these chemicals are actually toxic to our babies rather than the burden proof be on the industries that are profiting from these chemicals to show that they're safe before they're released to the environment. So I think that was a great point. So let me just also talk a little bit about the National Children's Study. You know, so we need better research on all the environmental influences on our children's health. And I think one of the most important is the National Children's Study. How many of you have heard of the National Children's Study? Okay. So it's the largest, the most ambitious study of children's health in our nation's history. It's the landmark study of generation. We're going to follow 100,000 kids from before birth up to 21 years of age, including 4,000 right here in Los Angeles County. Okay? We're going to their homes, and we're going to collect air sample, we're going to collect water sample, we're going to collect soil sample. We're going to be at the birth of every single child to collect umbilical cord blood, placenta, and we're going to try to figure out, okay, what causes autism, okay, what causes diabetes, what causes obesity, what causes asthma, and what can we do as a nation to prevent these preventable diseases and to really promote children's health and development. So again, I think that's probably a study that you should be aware of, and I think in Los Angeles, proud that we're part of this this national study. Okay. So let me, and then we're short on time here. So let me pick up a couple controversial topics that you. And your book was organized by the months of pregnancy. And I didn't think it was a good idea when you were 8 months pregnant to take on, and I would add very courageously, some very tough social issues such as abortion. Mm-hmm. In your view, how does fetal origins research change the abortion debate?
Well, that was something that was, even though I didn't get to it, as you say, until chapter 8, the second to last chapter of the book, it was something that I thought about a lot and how to handle it and what the reaction of readers would be. And I'm surprised to say, I'm not sure why, but when the book actually came out, it did not become a flashpoint in the, always ready to explode debate between pro-life people and pro-choice people. And what I decided to say, what I ended up saying in Origins about the abortion issue, is that the science of fetal origins complicates things for everybody. It's not kind of a slam dunk for either side, pro-life or pro-choice. If pro-choice forces, and I should say, among which I include myself as someone who is pro-choice, if they have sometimes looked at the fetus and talked about the fetus as a blob of tissue, the way that we've learned that the fetus responds and adapts and learns while in the womb kind of makes that implausible, makes that insupportable. On the other hand, if pro-life people have often talked about the fetus in isolation as if the woman is not even there, that's not supportable either, because we've learned now through the science of fetal origins about the intricate connection and relationship between pregnant woman and fetus and how they're really not separable, how one affects the other. Actually, as I get into my final chapter, how the fetus affects the woman, which is a very interesting kind of twist on all of this. But I talk about having gone to a pro-choice march when I was in college and seeing a sign that kind of caught me short. And it had a picture of a fetus with the words, "You've forgotten someone." And it did stop me in my tracks, because at that point, a young woman who was not interested in becoming pregnant, I had forgotten someone. I wasn't thinking about the fetus. And now, years later, having had two babies, I can see the wisdom in that, and then I can also see the wisdom in telling pro-life forces, "You've forgotten someone too. You've forgotten the woman." And if there's some way that the science of fetal origins could bring together these two sides and find whatever common interests they have, then I think that would be the most useful way to employ this new knowledge.
I think you also talk about a potential dark side of fetal origins research, that this research could be used to not only blame your mother for everything that's going wrong in your life, but that it could actually become an occasion to coerce and control the behavior of pregnant women. How do we prevent this research from being misused to blame or even criminalize women for their behaviors?
Yeah, I do worry about that, because the more that science shows that what happens to a fetus is affected by what a woman does, I think some people will take that as additional justification for intervening or coercing or forcing a pregnant woman to do what that authority figure sees fit. So I came out very strongly in Origins against that kind of coercion or manipulation. And my point of view is that the more that we know about how what the woman does affects the fetus, the more we're able to offer the help and resources that she needs. And that's what it has to be, an offer, because a woman doesn't become any less a human being or a citizen because she's pregnant. So I think, we've seen some sort of scary cases already of pregnant women being forced to have a cesarean against their will, things like that, or being arrested for delivering drugs to a fetus in her body. And I think, our focus needs to be on offering help rather than administering punishment.
And obviously, a lot of this is not just about individual behavior,
right?
But it's also about the social conditions, the social environment in which these women live. And so just want to bring up this one last topic before we open up to questions. It's this whole notion of fetal origins of social inequality. Okay? So in your book, you mentioned that fetal health may be the fulcrum of the black-white disparities in life outcomes, not only in terms of infant mortality or physical health or longevity, but also in terms of educational development, workplace earnings. What do you mean by that?
You ask coyly, because actually Michael is like the leading expert on racial disparities and their roots in so really I should just turn it right back to you. I mean, I do say in my book that the most effective anti-poverty programs should be those that begin before birth, because by the time a child is born, a lot has happened, and if we really want to get children off to a good start, then it's got to begin maybe even before conception and, making sure that young women of reproductive age are healthy and supported and have what they need to be healthy. So, but I'd really like to hear what you have to say about it.
Well, actually, let me, I just got appointed by the Secretary of Health and Human Services, Kathleen Sebelius, to chair the Secretary's Advisory Committee on Infant Mortality. And one of our biggest goals is to figure out how to close that disgraceful gap in infant mortality, that racial gap that we haven't been able to close for decades and decades. What should I tell the secretary?
Hello.
Hello. read this book.
Read, order many copies of my book. I think you should tell her that the prenatal period is crucial for our health and well-being extending over the rest of our lifetimes, and I would want you to show her all the evidence we have now that that's the case, and the animal evidence that helped persuade you, and then all the human evidence that we're now being able to gather. And I'd point out also that what we know from programs that help pregnant women, that those are often the best way to bring them into programs to help their children and help them after the birth, that this, that offering these kinds of prenatal services can be a really wonderful bridge to helping women and young children, you know, later on. So I just, to me, because I've spent so much time and because I feel so passionate about it, it seems like a no-brainer to invest money now at the beginning of life that will pay so many dividends later on, that the evidence is there. I just would hope she would look at it and draw from it the conclusion that I think is correct.
Yeah, and I think that the Nobel laureate economist James Heckman talked about, you know, you get a lot better kind of return on your investment if you invest early. And I really think that this book talks about investing before birth. And probably the last thing I would add is that if we really want to improve pregnancy outcomes and reduce disparities in pregnancy outcomes in this country, it's probably not just about improving women's health during pregnancy, but we got to start much earlier than that. Okay? That we really have to start before pregnancy. I'm not just talking about that one visit 3 months preconceptionally. I'm talking about when she was still a baby inside her mother's womb, and an infant, and a child, and an adolescent. We've got to do all the things that matter in terms of promoting women's health. Because by the time they come to see me for prenatal care, it's often too late. Yeah, for me to turn everything around and to optimize fetal programming for that next generation. Okay, so I really think that this message is not about improving, not just about improving prenatal care, but really improving the preconceptional health of I think both men and women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I think we have a little time for questions. Okay, so let's open for some questions. Do you want me to call on people?
Oh, I think.
No, okay.
Hi, thank you very much for addressing this topic so eloquently, and I'm definitely going to buy your book. Mm-hmm. I wanted to go back to what you were discussing about overweight women and overnutrition and how their children have health problems that look like undernourished women. From my work with pregnant women, obstetricians have a tendency to discuss weight gain and mm-hmm. never mention the word nutrition.
Mm-hmm.
So the women go home in a panic mm-hmm. because, oh, you gained 5 pounds this month. Mm-hmm. To which I would reply, my baby grew a lot. And they would go home and they would eat less. Mm-hmm. And they would suffer iatrogenic malnutrition because their obstetricians had 5 minutes in the room during which they scolded them for their weight and didn't discuss the difference between gaining 5 pounds on potato chips and gaining 5 pounds on broiled chicken and broccoli. So my question would be, how are we going to change the conversations with the obstetricians so that they are not accidentally causing women to undereat for fear of gaining weight?
Do you want me to take that question?
Yeah.
I guess I'm the obstetrician here. So, I actually serve on the Institute of Medicine committee that came out with the weight guidelines last year. And during committee meetings, we had a lot of consternation about the fact that, you know, we put out all of these guidelines that women can't meet, and we're probably doing them more of a disservice than a service if we don't figure out ways to help them actually achieve healthier weight gain during pregnancy. Yeah, certainly we could do better in as a profession in terms of talking about dietary quality, talking about nutrition and physical activities and so forth. But I think this is also a problem of our healthcare system, right? Because if you think about it, right now, the way prenatal care works is that you have this kind of know-it-all, you know, obstetrician, you know, that's supported maybe by some clerks and an ultrasound tech, and maybe a nurse that doubles as a health educator. Yeah. Does that sound, you know, given everything that you talked about in this book, given the importance of nutrition and stress and mental health and environmental exposures, you know, does that model of prenatal care sounds like quality care to you? Okay. How much counseling do you think is actually going on in the typical prenatal visit? Okay. And again, not to excuse the obstetricians, but most obstetricians didn't sign up for this. Okay. They don't have the training to do it. They don't have the time to do it. They aren't reimbursed to do it. And that's why you don't get the kind of quality care, and we're not doing everything we can to optimize fetal programming as we can. So there's need to be some rethinking that needs to take place in this country. And if I think part of the message that I'll tell the secretary is that we need to really think about the redesign of not just prenatal care, but women's health care across their life course continuum if we really want to, you know, do better in terms of promoting healthier weight gain during pregnancy.
Hi. As I've aged, I've decided to wait to have children just because I want to be more solid in my career and, you know, I want to be married for a while before I decide to have children. Is there anything in your book or in your research that suggests that this isn't such a bad idea, that maybe I could offset some of the concerns about a baby in my aged womb? I think about this. Yeah. That's why I stay healthy. That's why I eat well. That's why I exercise, not just for my health, because I know that, you know, I'm going to be 28 this year. I know 5 years down the road that, I mean, I don't feel old,
honey,
but I mean.
You are so far from me.
No, I know. But I know that I do think maybe I want to wait till I'm mid-30s. And I'm the eldest of six. My mom was at 38. She had twins. And so I think, well, my mom was, you know, but she started when she was 19. Mm-hmm. So I wonder, like, am I making these right decisions, and is there anything that I can do, you know, other than what I'm doing to make sure that I have a healthy newborn when the time comes?
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that fertility declines as you get older, so that would be something you'd want to think about, and that the rates of certain conditions like Down syndrome are found more often among women who are older. But that said, you know, whether you feel ready to be a mother is also a really important and legitimate aspect of deciding when to have a baby. So it's one of those things that you have to kind of keep all those things in balance. And certainly keeping yourself in general as healthy as possible, I think, is always a good idea. I mean, one of the amazing things that Dr. Liu does is get the word out about thinking about these issues, you know, in some cases long before you have a baby. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about preconception care and what that entails.
Yeah, and by the way, you're a baby. Because half of the women I see in my prenatal clinic and in my preconception care clinic are actually women in their late 30s, early 40s, and I always tell them, I'd rather be taking care of a woman who knows how to take care of themselves than the 20-year-old that is still completely stressed out and smoking and drinking and so forth. Okay, so, but I think that the message is clear that often by the time you get pregnant, it might be too late, you know, for me to do a quick tune-up on your body to like really optimize that fetal programming, and so the way to really make sure that you're going to have healthy pregnancy and healthy baby is doing exactly what you're doing. Okay, that you know, keep taking good care of yourself, and if you decide to have a baby when you're 35 or even 45, you know, that's going to be a lot. That makes that your pregnancy a lot healthier.
Hi, Annie. Thank you for your book, which I read and very much enjoyed. One thing about it that had surprised me a little bit is there wasn't any mention of third-party reproductive practices. Mm. And I was a little bit curious in all the findings and studies that you cite, in instances where there's no biological connection and a woman is pregnant via donor egg or donor embryo, or perhaps as a gestational surrogate, do the findings about maternal influence hold just as strongly, again, when there's no direct genetic connection, but there still is maternal influence, like someone who is a gestational surrogate, but not the intended parent?
Yeah, while I was writing this book, a movie came out, and I'm forgetting that maybe it was called Baby Mother, Baby Mama. It was, it was with Tina Fey, and and it was about how, you know, she was this uptight, type A personality who was using a woman as her surrogate who was like, you know, I don't know, eating Twinkies and smoking and whatever, and like, how is her baby going to turn out? So it was really like, in a very broad comic way, like this question. And there is some research emerging now. There was a really interesting experiment in carried out in Britain that looked at was sort of a natural experiment, except it's an experiment of nature, but it's the most artificial kind of experiment you can imagine, where they looked at women who were surrogates using eggs from another woman. So then you can look at, you know, the genetic contribution versus the, they were raised by a third person. So the parts had been teased apart. There was the mother who reared the child, there was the mother who donated the egg for the child, and there was the mother who provided the womb for gestating the child. And that allowed that arrangement, and kind of studying those arrangements, allowed these scientists to make, in this case, an interesting distinction about the effects of cigarette smoking during pregnancy. That women who smoke cigarettes during pregnancy did produce children with lower birth weights. That when you kind of clear all the genetic confounders out of that held. But another finding that had been in the literature was that smoking during pregnancy was connected to behavioral problems. And that was, it was always unclear, is that about the smoking during pregnancy? Is it about growing up with secondhand smoke? Is it about being born of parents who would smoke when they were pregnant? You know, that kind of, all kinds of things. And that kind of washed out, that the behavioral stuff washed out in this experiment that managed to separate those three strands. So I think as we're able to do more of these kinds of experiments, and it's hard to think how we can get at these questions otherwise, perhaps something like the experiment that I mentioned earlier about women who had pregnancies before and after their anti-obesity surgery. You know, you're looking at the same woman but two different intrauterine environments. It's very hard to tease these things apart, but I think it's an incredibly interesting question, and one that is has happened too recently, really, to be included here. Maybe a second edition.
Question over here.
Hi. You kind of touched on this when you were talking about the level of stress and you want to fall somewhere in that inverted U, but more to the point of the levels of environmental factors like air quality. How do you reconcile the fetal programming hypothesis with that of the hygiene hypothesis, wherein a certain level of exposure to germs helps promote a healthy immune system?
You want to take that one?
Sure. Great question, and the hygiene hypothesis is somewhat controversial. It's saying that the cleaner the environment, the greater the likelihood of respiratory tract disorders such as asthma, there are probably two explanations for it, and we don't know which one is right, and there's a lot of active research that's going on. One is the same idea of that U-shaped curve, not too little, not too much, but just right, okay? You don't want your baby or your child to grow up in a bubble, okay? This way their immune system never gets challenged, never develops a certain level of competence, but you don't want to be too much, that it starts to overwhelm an immature system. Okay, so that's one hypothesis around this. The second, and there may be some evidence for this, is that in order to maintain that hygiene, what are we using? We're using all the antibacterial soaps and all the chemicals, bleaches and everything, and it may be the chemicals that's cleaning up your home that's actually inducing the asthma rather than the hygiene itself. Okay, so we don't know which is right, and certainly a very important area of research, but I do think that avoiding avoidable toxicants and not overwhelming your baby or child with all of these potential developmental toxicants, I think would be very important to do.
Hi. I'm 29 weeks now, and I got your book.
Congratulations.
thank you. And 42 years old, by the way. And happened the natural way, or the old-fashioned way. And thank you for allowing me to have chocolate in a very guilt-free way. It's a wonderful study.
I should say, this is a study that is at the end of my chapter about food and nutrition that says that eating chocolate on a regular basis when you're pregnant is associated with a lower risk of preeclampsia and a happier temperament in your baby once he's born. So I just took that as license to eat chocolate whenever I wanted.
And I was hearing you guys talk a lot about public health issues. And being in my third trimester, I'm starting to think about my fourth trimester. And I'm doing a lot of research about the question of vaccination. And the proponents of vaccinations are talking about it as a public health issue, and the opponents of vaccination are talking about it as a public health issue. And I'm ping-ponging between what to do, what's best for the baby. Like, they're talking a lot about chronic illnesses like diabetes and asthma, and I understand that the autism connection has been pretty much debunked at this point. But there are other issues in terms of the preservatives, the vaccinations, and the whole story about the pharmaceutical companies getting them through too fast. And I just wanted to know, A, what your views are, if you can talk about that a little bit, and B, what might you suggest I do in terms of further research to find a more balanced view?
Well, vaccines is certainly not anything I'm could claim to be an expert on, but my understanding is that vaccinations are important to do, and important to do for your own child's health and for the health of everybody else's children. But maybe Michael has a different view.
No, I think anytime you use anything in pregnancy, anytime you use something on a baby, it's that risk benefit calculus. Okay, And so what's the risk of the vaccine versus what's the risk of disease that preventable disease as a result of not vaccinating during pregnancy or not vaccinating your child? And sometimes that may be a tough calculus, but I think for most of us who study this stuff, and for most of us who are interested in public health, the weight of evidence seems to come down on the side of vaccination. Because I think, for example, with the flu vaccine, okay, we certainly know that there are lots of studies demonstrating a relationship between getting the flu during pregnancy and increased risk for autism and schizophrenia and so forth. And it makes a lot of sense within the context of this book, and the fetal origins research, that when you get sick, your body releases all of those inflammatory mediators that can cross the placenta and to cause damage to the baby's brain. Okay, and that evidence is really strong. It's real. Okay, we don't know what the risk of the vaccine to the baby. And certainly there's some concern about things like the mercury preservative. And so I always make sure that I give my patients the timerosal-free vaccine. But I sit down with them and we talk about this. Okay, we don't know everything, and that's what a lot of that the National Children's Study and a lot of other research has to be done so that we could, 20 years from now, be able inform our patients about this. But presently, kind of weighing the weight of the evidence, I think that the risk of the disease still outweighs the risk of the vaccine.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering about things like that, where we've all had chickenpox, and that thereby given, the immunity for, say, things like shingles later on, mm-hmm. I don't know why we would vaccinate for chickenpox. Yeah. Things like that. I mean, that's just sort of... Yeah.
Thank you very much for compiling a lot of the research that I have had to work really hard to find along the way. So I'm really looking forward to getting a lot of the things that I've missed out in my research. My work and my research revolves around the psyche of the pregnant woman. And I'm kind of blown away at how much fear is out there. The fact that almost everyone shares the worst birth story they know to a woman who's pregnant, I think is one big indicator. And then the fact that a third of the women out there have been sexually abused in their life. These are all parts of things that come to light and to surface when you're pregnant. And I'm just wondering what your thoughts are about fear, about the fact that we also have so many pregnant women who are on antidepressants and dealing with this fear in an active way. And I'll just leave it out that way for you to touch on it however, it comes to mind.
Yeah. I actually devote a chapter in Origins to the effects of two moods and feelings during pregnancy and its their potential effect on the fetus. And it was a very interesting chapter to me because I talk in the chapter about how I experienced some feelings of sadness during pregnancy, and my greatest fear was that I was passing those feelings on to my child to be. And I brought some of my questions to a psychiatrist at Columbia named Catherine Monk, who does a lot of research on mental illness during pregnancy and its effect on the fetus. And she has a very interesting, if perhaps disturbing to some of us, theory about intrauterine conditions forming a kind of third way that mental illness might be passed down in families. That we know that some families have a genetic predisposition to developing certain kinds of mental illness. We know that the disturbed parenting of a mentally ill parent can foster mental illness in a child. And it may be, suggests Monk, that the intrauterine environment is the third way that depression or anxiety or a predisposition to those things could be passed down. So this is a lot of fetal origins research is still in this kind of speculative stage, but that was very interesting to me and sad. And I actually watched an experiment she conducted with a very pregnant and very depressed young woman, and it was very disturbing to see, because even though we know that we know now that pregnancy does not protect against mental illnesses like depression, we still, I think, on some level expect pregnant women to be happy and radiant and joyful, and that can get in the way of treatment for pregnant women who need it. Because one statistic that really struck me was that the best predictor of postpartum depression, depression that happens after the baby's born, is prepartum depression. So if we can catch women while they're pregnant, we can start helping them and we can start helping the women and their babies before their babies are born. And so I think this is something that a lot of people don't like to talk about, as I say, because we have certain cultural expectations of pregnant women. But I think it's incredibly important to talk about it, to talk about the pros and cons, as Dr. Liu was saying, of in this case of weighing the risks of antidepressant medication against the risks of untreated depression, and not assuming that the drugs are always going to be worse, you know. But I think we need to get past the general stigma that surrounds mental illness in this country, and also the particular kind of mindset that says a pregnant woman should always be happy, is always happy and should be, and you don't want to hear anything else. So I think it's a really important thing to bring up.
So I think we got it close. We'll stay around for your questions, but my girl is getting sleepy, so we gotta close this. So let me just close by expressing my gratitude to you for writing this book. Over the last several years, I had several opportunities of sharing the lectern with Dr. Barker, and in conversations with him, you can just feel that sense of frustration. That the urgency of his message isn't reaching out to the public, that we gotta do so much better, and we can do so much better in terms of improving the health of our population. Hey, and I think you've done an amazing job helping us get the word out, and our field really owe you a debt of gratitude for that.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Lin.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.